I'll start anyway now. Okay, so a bit about internet security protocols and standards today. We'll talk about secure email and SMIME in particular, and also something about something that is called domain keys identified mail. So it also has to do with secure email. Secure socket layer, transport layer security is a topic of today. HTTPS, so the secure web browsing, and then I will say something in general about IP security, IPsec. I'll start with secure email and SMIME. So first, when email was invented a long, long time ago, it was described in an RFC, request for comments, and the description was rather simple at the time. Rather basic, it was tailored to just ASCII text as an email content, so that was not the email that we know today. Simple headers were only used, so this email coming is going to this person, is coming from this person, this is a subject, so nothing very very extensive. An extension of this RFC came when they defined MIME, multi-purpose internet mail exchange, where new headers were used also, and where there was also a standard for different content than just simple ASCII text. So they had something for images and audio and video also. But both the original RFC and MIME did lack support for security for email. So because of that, they went over to what is called SMIME, so secure MIME. Again, there was when they defined this particular standard, there was also some additional content types, but they also had support for four different security measures. First, there was confidentiality, so envelope data, so the content of the email could be secured, could be kept confidential. There was something called signed data, which provided integrity, and also clear signed data, which provided integrity. Both of them are more or less the same, except that in, and now I have to be careful not to make a mistake, in signed data, both the content and the signature are BASE64 encoded. So at the very least, when I see the email, it's not apparent what is the content of the email. Yeah, the signature needs to be BASE4 encoded, because otherwise you might have some control characters in there that do something strange, so it has to be a format that is interpretable in plain text. But at least the content was looked like scrambled in signed data, not in clear signed data. Didn't add any extra security. Didn't provide confidentiality, of course, because even though you needed an SMIME capable email client to be able to see it, in principle you could just take the BASE64 encoded text and just translate it yourself. So clear signed data, they only focus on the signature and have BASE64 encoding for that, and leave the message as it is. So those provide integrity, and then obviously also the combination of integrity and confidentiality was provided. This picture, I think we have seen that before. So what happens? I have an email and I want to have confidentiality for that, and I want to have integrity for that. Integrity is not included here. This is just confidentiality. No, it's also integrity. Sorry, first picture is integrity. So what is done is I'll take the message and I'll find the signature for that message, which I then add at the bottom of the message. So that's the integrity part. And then I want to do encryption of the message and the signature. And so I encrypt everything, and I do the encryption with some kind of symmetric key. So that's the key there in the middle, the one-time session key. I use that with, in this particular example, triple desk to encrypt the message and the signature. And then that key has to be sent also to the receiver. What I'll do is I'll take that particular key and I use the public key of the receiver, Alice in this case, to encrypt that key. And then I'll send it. And then I do the base 64 or radix 64 encoding to make sure that, yeah, it's understandable. It doesn't do anything strange along the way. Yeah, and then Alice, as the receiver, what she does is she undoes the radix 64 decoding. She then finds the part where the one-time key is encoded, and she can decrypt that using her private key. Once she has that, she can then decrypt the remainder of the message, which is the message plus the signature in that case. And then once she has the message with the signature again, she can check the signature using Bob's public key. So that's, we have seen this before. We also have seen this where the signature is created. We have a message and we use some kind of hash to get a hash value of that message, which we then encrypt using a private key. And that the result of that encryption is added to the message. So that was actually the first step in the previous slide. Once it's transmitted on the other side, the signature part is taken apart and is decrypted using the public key of that of the sender. And the resulting value should be the hash of the message. So I'll take the message again, I hash it, and I see if the result of the hash on the message and the decryption of the signature, if that is the same. If so, then it's okay. This is in words. Has the message with, for example, SHA-1, and then use the digital signature standard to do the encryption, etc., etc. This is more or less what I just said. Alternatives are, for example, using RSA with SHA-1 or MD5. So it doesn't really depend on the algorithms that are used. Yeah, and then, as I said, in principle, that the result of certainly of the signature is a random string, or looks random. Yeah, and so it doesn't make sense as a set of bytes in terms of plain text. And so what is used is radix64 mapping to make sure that at least we get printable characters and nothing strange is going on. So how is that mapping working? Radix64 means that there are actually 64 printable characters that are used. Well, 64, why 64? 64 is 2 to the power 6. Yeah, so every time that I see 6 bits, I'll make one printable character of that. And a printable character is a byte. So I'm actually taking 6 bits and turning that into 1 byte. Or in other words, I'm taking 24 bits or 3 bytes and turning them into 4 bytes. That's what they are doing. If padding is needed, I will exclude the padding here. So here we have the 24 bits, 3 bytes, 3 times 8 bits, and we'll just split it up in 6 bits every time. We use the mapping to get 8 bits from each of the 6 bits, and then we have 4 resulting bytes. And the mapping is done as follows. So there is a big table. If the 6 bits were all 0, I'll take that into the character A, and there is an ASCII value for that, the capital A. Yeah, if it was 5 zeros and a 1, it will become the capital B, or the corresponding ASCII value for that, etc., etc., all the way to the end. So, for example, as a small exercise for you, if this is the input, these 3 bytes, what will be the output? Pen and paper works best here. Or a keyboard, a notepad, or whatever. Anybody reach the answer already? Let's go and see if it works. So we have the three bytes. So this was a byte. This was a byte. And this was a byte. And we'll split it up into 4 times 6 bits. So 00100, that's the first 6 bits, etc., etc. That's the splitting. And then we're going to find out which value this is. Well, this represents value 1, 2, 4, 8. This represents 8. And this is 32 plus 16 is 48 plus 5 is 53. That is 48 again, plus 2 is 50. And this is 32 plus, 16 plus 1 is 17. Right? I hope I didn't make a mistake. Yeah. And then we look at the table. And at the table, first value is 8. I look at the table, and 8, it says capital I. Then 53 in the last column, that is the number 1. 50, also in the last column, is small y. And 17, top of almost the top of the second column, capital R. Yeah, so that's the result of the... So the output will be I1, small y, R. Yeah, that's all. Nothing more, nothing less. Not very complicated. Then obviously I1YR is again, we look at the ASCII table for that. The I is apparently 01001001, yeah, etc., etc. So I look up in the ASCII table what the 8-bit values are. Yeah, so on those 3 bytes of input on the top, the resulting 4 bytes are outputted. So that was a bit about the signature and the Radix 64 encoding. S/MIME has some default algorithms, being triple DAS and ELGAMAL. ELGAMAL we did not treat it in the CryptoPod, but that is also an asymmetric algorithm that can be used to create signatures. And S/MIME generates by itself the symmetric key that is here used in the middle part to do the symmetric encryption. As in all, doesn't matter if it's ELGAMAL or any other asymmetric algorithm, the public key of the receiver is used to do the encryption of the session key, and the private key of the sender is used to do the signature. Right, so this is how it's done. But these are the standard algorithms. You can choose other algorithms in S/MIME. And as I said, the receiver will use his own or her own private key, ELGAMAL key, to retrieve the session key again. Yeah, I think we discussed that already. When we're talking about public and private keys again, yeah, public keys, they need a certificate. Same as all the public keys, we cannot trust that a public key that you see somewhere is correct unless we can check it, and we use this public key infrastructure for that. That contains certificates. Certificates are signed again by certificate authority, etc., etc. The asymmetric crypto, the both algorithms that are used in S/MIME are DSS, the Digital Signature Standard, and ELGAMAL, and there should be certificates. As I said, and the certificate that I use in S/MIME are the X509 version 3 certificates that we discussed last week. Nothing very special there. Yeah? Clear? If so, then let's continue with the domain keys inter-identified mail. First, something about email architecture in general. If I want to send an email, then my email server will send out that message, and that will be collected by what is called a mail submission agent, and then that uses a number of mail transfer agents to send it over the internet to the receiver. And once it reaches the receiver, a message store then captures that email and will keep it there until the user comes, the receiver comes and collects it from the message store. If we talk about S/MIME before, there is actually encryption between the message user agent on this side and the message user agent on that side. That's what S/MIME is doing. So I need a special email client that is capable of doing S/MIME. Unfortunately, not everybody has that. Not all email clients are capable of doing that. So if I have an S/MIME enabled client, but you don't have it, I can't send you a protected secret email because your email client doesn't support it. Yeah, so both sides need to have that. And so, yeah, because there are few people that have, relatively few people that use S/MIME, it's not that effective. So that's where domain key identified mail comes in place. This works by encrypting emails between domains. So it's not the mail user agent that is doing the encryption of the email. It's actually the mail submission agent that is doing that. And the decryption is done not again by the user agent on the other side, but by the message store. By doing this, we can they can provide not confidentiality but integrity. And actually, there where S/MIME only would encrypt and authenticate the content of the email, so does the main keys identified mail also include some of the parts of the header. And so there is some more security in terms of integrity, but yeah, no confidentiality is provided. Default algorithm apparently is RSA with char 256, but alternatives are possible. And as said, the signature will be added. Signature, because we're only talking about integrity. Signature will be added by the MSA, and it will be checked at the other side. So if I, slightly different picture now, we have the mail user agent on this side, and he, in this case, she is not doing anything related to security. That will be added by the MSA. So there the signature will be added to the email, and then it's sent to the other side, and the delivery agent on the other side can get public keys from a DNS server, and then they can check the signature, and once the signature checks out, can forward it to the user. Yeah, so S/MIME actually had secure communication between one user agent and the other user agent, so between users. Domain keys identified mail has it between domains only. So there are some slight differences. Yeah, but you see that there are different ways of doing this. Because, as I said, because few people have S/MIME capabilities on their email server, that doesn't work that well. This is just an agreement between complete domains. So independent of how many users there are in a domain, as long as the MSA and the MDA have a capability to do integrity checking, then it's okay. Okay, good. The next topic is SSL and TLS, but I will not say anything about that because Thomas will come at 12:15, so in about half an hour, and he will give a presentation on that together with Heartbleed. So you will have to wait for that. Did anybody start on the topic already, on the project? The assignment, I should say. Not reading? Okay. Some not. Okay, I will continue with HTTPS. So we all know HTTP. Yeah, the hypertext, what is it, hypertext? Transcript language. Transcript protocol, sorry. So we all know that. That's used in web browsers to make sure that the content looks nice, as it should be. But there is no security in there by default. So there is HTTPS, which provides a security. So HTTP secure, or whatever you want to call it. And that is a combination of HTTP together with SSL or TLS. Most web browsers do have HTTPS implemented already, so in general you can use it a lot. You can, if you go to Facebook, you can go through it through HTTP or use HTTPS. I advise you to always use HTTPS. Might be a bit slower, but it is more secure. So the browsers, the web browsers, the clients, all have the capability. But so the support depends very much on the web server, so the other side. If they support HTTPS, then you can use it. So look always at the start of a URL. If it starts with HTTP, there's no security, and the protocol will use port 80 in that case. If it starts with HTTPS, there is security. And actually the port that is used, you can't see that, but the port that is used is 443. So they use a different port. What is secured? The URL of the requested document. Not so much the domain. That's clear because the request is going to a particular domain. But what document on that server you are requesting, that is secured. Content of the document, obviously, that you're retrieving. That is secured. If you're sending information that you filled in on a form, all that information, so the content is secured, but not that you are connecting to a specific web server. The HTTP client also serves as a TLS client, so that's integrated then. And TLS, you haven't heard about TLS yet, but TLS starts with a handshake. There is the client and the server, and they want to set up a connection and a secure connection. And in order to do that, they have to start with a handshake that Thomas will talk about. And once that is done, wasn't me. Still working? Yeah. Sorry. Somewhere in my sentence, I lost everything. Once the handshake is there to set up the secure connection, to exchange keys, etc., to come to a common key. What is actually done in HTTPS is that the HTTP content is actually used. The HTTP protocol is actually used as content in the TLS application. Yeah, that's closing. That's not that important. So once I am done sending the information, if I want to close the information, I can either close the HTTP connection, or I can close the TLS connection. That works both ways. Okay, good. Then the last part now is about IP version 4 or IP version 6 security, so IP security. Why? Because what we talked about so far was S/MIME or email security. We talked about browser security. Those are very specific protocols. So I have an application that provides its own security. But there are many applications which are not email or which are not web browser. And they don't have security. Yeah, they could come up with their own protocol also. But what is needed is some kind of general security. If you're using IP traffic, just secure that traffic. No matter if that is email or web content or something else, we'll just secure all the IP traffic. And there we can actually see three different components. We can provide confidentiality. So prevent against eavesdropping, that the content becomes readable. We can provide authentication, making sure that the other side is the person we are talking to, integrity. And then there is also the component of key management. We need that also. So IP security can take care of all three of those. And actually, there are two protocols. IPsec version 3 takes care of the confidentiality and the authentication, while the IKE, the Internet Key Exchange Protocol, takes care of the key management part. So when we talk about IP security, both of them have to work together. Some benefits, you can read about all about that. Transparent to end users. I think the most advantage comes from the fact that this is global. This holds for any traffic that is going over the internet. Yeah, so not just specifically email or whatever. When we look at IPsec, more or less from the previous slide, you could also derive that there are two main functions. One is providing authentication, and that protocol is called, or that function is called authentication header. Yeah, only authentication. And there is encapsulating security payload, and that provides encryption, so confidentiality. And it says here and authentication, but and optionally authentication also, but generally authentication is included there. Because ESP exists and it is was being used more and more, actually authentication header is used less and less. So why just have authentication if I could also have a little extra cost to have encryption and confidentiality? Yeah, so authentication header is depreciated. It's still there, it's still in the protocol, just for backward compatibility. So if there is an old version of IPsec that would not support ESP, at the very least, authentication header can be used. In IPsec, the security depends on what is called security associations. And that's a key concept. A security association is related to one way of the communication. So from the sender to the receiver or from the receiver to the sender. Yeah, so security association just says something about one way. So in order to have a secure communication back and forth, I need two security associations, one from me to the receiver and one from the receiver back to me. Because there will then be multiple security associations running or active on this machine, it needs to be able to determine to uniquely find the correct one. Yeah, no, it's not too far. Yeah. So a security association actually is uniquely defined by a few parameters. There is a security parameter index, just a local identifier, just a random number. Then there is the destination address. Yeah, so that security association is used to send information to somebody and to who that is in the IP address, the destination address, and then which protocol is used. Is this a security association for the authentication header protocol or for the ESP protocol? If you look at the content of a security association, you see more information. Of course, there is a sequence number. So it's not just one packet that I can send, but I can send multiple packets, but I have to keep track of where I am so that I know the order of the packets, if packets are missing, if packet numbers are used again, so then there is something going on. What more? There's much more. Algorithms and keys need to be identified for either the authentication header protocol or for ESP, depends on what. How long is this, the security association valid? So there is an expiry date on that, and that can be either in real time, this one expires at 12 today, or it can be an amount of data. Yeah, after I've sent so much data, you have to renew the security association. Yeah, and some more information. not that important. Well, one thing is also important. What protocol mode is used? There you see that they use tunnel mode or transport mode. Those are the important ones. I'll get back to that in a second, what the exact difference between those two is. Here you see a packet for the encapsulated security payload. There is the security parameter index at the beginning, so that was used for the identification. The sequence number, and then the payload data. So that depends on the protocol and everything. Padding if needed, pad length and next header, so that's some technical information. If you look at it, ESP provides confidentiality and authentication. The confidentiality is on the gray part. The authentication is actually on the full part of the packet. And then the authentication data is added to the end. So I'll do the confidentiality first, and so the payload data is encrypted, and that gray area is not visible anymore. And then I'll take that with the SPI and the sequence number, and then I take care that there is some authentication data at the end based on that. Okay, I mentioned transport mode and tunnel mode. So what is that? In transport mode, the payload of an IP packet is secured. Not the header or anything, just the content, the payload. So what I'll do is I'll leave the header intact, and I'll just make sure that the payload is authenticated and encrypted. I can still see a lot of information of where this packet is going and everything. Yeah, but the content, what I'm sending, that is secured. The other is the tunnel mode. And actually the tunnel mode will provide confidentiality or security of the full IP packet. So all of it is encrypted. Well, if all of it is encrypted, the destination IP address is encrypted too. That's, what do I do with that? Well, what they do in tunnel mode is actually take that original IP packet and have protection for that one. And then what I get here, this encrypted and authenticated information, is then actually the payload of a new IP packet. So I build a new IP packet around it. That has then an IP address, a destination IP address, related to the old one. Not the exact old one, but related. I'll get back to that in the next slide. Yeah. So all of the original IP packet that I am sending is not visible anymore. Only a wrapper IP packet is visible, and the content, the data, the payload of that IP packet, that is all encrypted. That's my old IP packet. Transport mode I use typically between end users. So from one end user to another one. And so it encrypts its ESP, it encrypts and optionally authenticates the IP payload, not the IP header again. The tunnel mode is used between domains. So I send from one domain to the other domain. That means that I have to change the destination and the source address, but I have to do that in a smart way. And on the way from one domain to the other one, the original content is not visible. It's encrypted data. So here in the picture, transport mode was between one end user and another end user. And because still the packet from this user is sent to that user, it has to be sent there. So information like source IP address and destination IP address and everything, that should be visible. Yeah, because from the receiver, there should probably go a packet back, and so source address is needed again, etc., etc. But what is sent, the content, that is protected. Tunnel mode means that actually if that is the router at one domain and the router for another domain, then they set up a secure connection. Everything, there is a big pipeline between those two routers, and every traffic that is going from one domain to the other domain is going through this big pipeline and is protected completely. So those are the IP addresses, the IP packets that are completely protected. Yeah, so if these two are talking, this one is addressing the IP address of the other user as the destination IP address, has his own source IP address as the as source IP address. Then he's sending it to its to the router. The router will then take that packet, completely protect it, add its own source IP address, so from the router, not from the user, from the router, have as a destination IP address the IP address from the router on the other side, and send that. So I can see that there is traffic from one domain to another domain, but I don't know who in the first domain is talking to who in the other domain. I can only see that there is communication between the two domains. Is that clear? Okay, good. That was actually all the slides that I had for today. Any questions? If not, then approximately 12:15, maybe a bit earlier, Thomas will be here and will be set up, so we'll have a break until then. Yeah.
questions and more.
If there are questions from the audience.
How many did we take this one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The remainder of today will be filled by Thomas, who is my colleague here at the university. He is our expert on networks and network security and everything, and he will give you a presentation on the recent, what I called recent in my yeah. assignment, but I don't think it's recent anymore, about Heartbleed anyway, about the bug in the OpenSSL implementation.
Yes.
Okay, Thomas. Okay.
Thank
you,
Patrick. Yeah, welcome. I want to talk today a little bit about Heartbleed, a flaw in OpenSSL, and how did Heartbleed work, and what's the essentials of it, and what's the situation today. So Heartbleed was appearing in 2014. It was when I was starting here my job at NTNU, former HEEK, Hochschule in Jövik, and it was one of the first flaws, big flaws, appearing in spring 2014, Heartbleed. So what I want to talk today, it's about half an hour, 40 minutes. I will give a short introduction in Heartbleed. I have a comic, found a good comic, and I'm allowed to present it here. Then we will talk a little bit about transport layer security, SSL and TLS, which is the basis where the Heartbleed flaw is working on. Then I introduce the RFC 6520, that was this RFC. Okay, this is a Heartbleed RFC, which is the basis for developing the Heartbleed flaw. Then I talk only very short about buffer allocation in C, because it is a problem of C programming. It's a common problem we have always today. with buffer overflow, it's the opposite direction. It's not buffer overflow, it's readout data of the memory. I will shortly give some introduction about OpenSSL according to this flaw, and we'll talk about why this happens and the structure of the OpenSSL group. And then I have two, three slides of the functioning of Heartbleed. Sorry. Okay. Let's see how the Heartbleed bug works. Well, if we have an encrypted connection like TLS or IPsec, that appears the time during the time that there is no communication for a dedicated time, and so that the systems find out whether this connection is still available or not, there is an interchange between the devices. And here is an example of this. The interchange could be that someone asks server, "Hey, are you still there? If so, reply potato." Six letters. So I ask for the word and give the length of the word. And then the server answers, "Oh, Mac," this is Mac, "wants these three letters and potato." And the server answers with potato. This is a Heartbleed. So the Heartbleed is swinging between the systems. So in regular times, Mac is asking the server, "Give me a dedicated answer with the length of letters." And if it comes, Mac knows the system is running. So the second answer could be, "Server, are you still there? If so, reply bird," four letters. What does the server reply? Bird. Wonderful. And now Mac is thinking, "Wow, this is an interesting thing. I give the server an information, some word, payload, and I give the server the length of the word. So what can you do? What would you try to do when you are in this situation? You're a player, gamer. Any idea? Yeah? Yes, and this is Mac doing. Okay, this is the Heartbleed. Now MacOS server, are you still there? If so, reply head. 5,500 letters. What does the server do? Yes, the next 497 letters. So, could you read it? It's a little bit small. So, we have here, this is the memory of the server. And the server is answering. Mac wants these 500 letters, head plus. So, head is here, for those who cannot read it, we have this word, this request, head. And then we have 500 letters. And including in this 500 letters, we find here something like if, brackets, administrator, set the server at master key to another value. So what is the server doing? The server says, okay, the request is about head, three letters, and another 500. And when we are lucky, and we see at the end of the lecture that in this case we are mostly lucky, then we get another 500 or 497 letters, and maybe it includes the server key, the password, or whatever. And this is the way this Heartbleed flaw works. So we pretend we order the server to give us more information than we normally ask in this way. And this is the point we want to see. This is the clear Heartbleed in the comic. And we see now in detail how this works. Anybody knows this logo? Heartbleed logo? This is the reason why the Heartbleed, Heartbleed is called like this. Okay, when we want to understand how Heartbleed works, we need to understand the transport layer security protocol, TLS, because this is the basic or the basis of this implementation in OpenSSL where it appears. So transport layer security was developed in the 90s by Netscape and was called SSL, Secure Socket Layer. And then IETF take over the responsibility, Internet Engineering Task Force, everybody of you know this. What are the standards the IETF are defining? You know it. The standards defined by IETF are called RFCs, request for comments, right. And there is, of course, an RFC for TLS available. So the version, normally used version today, is 1.2, and 1.3 is available as a draft. What kind of security communications we have in our network communication? Well, we know network layer security, which is not part of this lecture here. We have IPsec on layer 3, and above IPsec we have the transport protocols and our applications. What we are talking about is transport layer security. And this transport layer security is working above layer 4, above the transport layer. This is the reason why it's called transport layer security. And the IP is transparent. The protocols TCP and UDP are also transparent in this way. And here, the SSL TLS. TLS is a synonym for SSL as the newer development here, is put here. And our application, HTTP, SMTP, FTP, whatever we have, simple network management protocol, they will be added with this S for security and using this protocol. So this is the way the protocol works. Let's go more in detail. We are talking about TLS based on the Internet Protocol. We have the two transport protocols, UDP, it's connectionless, best effort transport protocol, and TCP with a connection-oriented issue or behavior. And above this, we have the transport layer security. And the transport layer security, you see it here on the box, is a little bit more complex. And I want to explain this because we have to understand how TLS works, so that we understand how Heartbleed our heart bleed is working. Well, the transport layer protocol consists of several protocols. One of the protocols is the so-called heartbeat protocol. We see a little later how it works. We have a handshake protocol, we see also soon. We have change CIPA specification. This is responsible for negotiation between the partners, what kind of cipher suite encryption should be used. We have some alert protocols, so if something is wrong, something is not working in correct way, in an unsecure way, alerts will be produced and maybe shut down the connection. And we have our applications. We have our applications here, and they will be transferred to an application protocol, and then we have our communication. But here we see we only have control protocols. What we need is an additional protocol. It's called record layer protocol. So here all the behaviors, all the elements will be negotiated and determined, and then the application comes, and on the record layer protocol, the encryption, the secured communication takes place. And this looks like this. So first, let's talk one word about the record protocol. This provides confidentiality, integrity for the secure socket layer or transport layer in this way. It works, our data coming to the system will be fragmented, will be compressed. We add a MAC. What is MAC? Media access control? No, MAC has several meanings. In this case, it's message authentication control. So this is a hash value of the message, will be added, this will be encrypted and sent out. This is more or less the part of our record protocol here. And all the parameters we need for MAC, for encryption and so on, they will be negotiated here on the upper layer of the TLS. So what will be defined? Secret keys for symmetric encryption and the MAC defined during SSL handshake. So handshake protocol, we have it here. And what kind of MAC, what kind of encryption mechanism will be used is defined and negotiated up in this layer. The MAC includes a secret number. This you know from the bachelor. This secret number is nonce. Sometimes also used for preventing man-in-the-middle attacks, and the data when they received will be processed in the reverse order. This is the way on the record level. This is not very complicated, and this is not what we want to look in depth. But let's look here to the handshake protocol, this one, before we go later on to the heartbeat protocol. Well, the handshake protocol, we have our client here, our server here, starts with the client with a hello, sending the protocol version, TLS 1.2, for example, and a list of supported algorithms, encryption algorithms, and random nonce, which will be used for secure communication. The second step, the server answers. The server answers with a hello, and chooses the strongest symmetric, asymmetric, symmetric and algorithm, asymmetric algorithm, the MAC algorithm, and sends a random nonce. And the strongest algorithm will be taken from the supported algorithm of the client. You see here there is a weakness. What weakness do you see here? Or don't you see any weakness? Exactly. So the server needs to have a level of the maximum secure encryption algorithm he will accept. Otherwise, he will reject the request for the TLS algorithm. If the server doesn't do, the client can use a very low or weak crypto algorithm here in this case, and this will be cause a security problem. Then the server sends a certificate, includes the public key of the server, a server key exchange, temporary RSE key, depends on the chosen algorithm. a certificate request in the case that the server wants a certificate from the client. This is not used in the most cases. So when you start your web browser and have a TLS connection to a web server, you normally don't send your certificate to the web server because he is not requesting it. But it could be. And after this, server hello done here, end of the server hello. These are the first two steps of a TLS connection. Then the client answers with a certificate, if it is requested, mostly not. Client keys change. Client generated a pre-master secret encrypted with the public key of the server after certificate verification. And the pre-master secret plus nonce are used to generate the master secret, which is later on the basis for all secrets and keys for this connection. I don't go in detail in this. This you can read down in the literature how this works. So, but the pre-master secret will be generated by the clients. This is important. Then the certificate verify client signature over previous messages used by the server to verify client's identity, if it is used, not in every case. And then steps 10, change cipher specification means from this point on, the client will communicate in an encrypted way. So the record layer protocol will use the negotiated values. And then there is a finished handshake done. Of course, the server has to do the same. The server then also changed to cipher specific spec. It's also communicating in encrypted way and finished it the same as step 11 of what the client is doing. So the handshake is complete and exchange of encryption and authentication messages starts between client and server after all these steps. You see, there is a lot of communication necessary to set up a TLS connection. And then, of course, you do not want to do this all the time, cost a lot of resources and time. And so if you establish a connection like this, you want to keep it alive as long as you want to communicate. And to take care on that it is alive, we have this wonderful heartbeat protocol. You see it here. And now we want to see the heartbeat protocol. The heartbeat protocol is defined in an RFC, Request for Comments. So it's also an ITF definition. Who has read an RFC of you? Not so many. You should do it. If you are familiar and want to work with the internet, you should read RFCs because it's a special kind of structure these guys working with RFCs are using and to understand it. This is a typical form of an RFC. I want not to go in detail in this. So this RFC is working on the heartbeat extension, and from this heartbeat, the heartbleed is derived. So the RFC 6520 is the transport layer security and datagram transport layer security heartbeat extension. So why is it like this? Well, TLS is based on reliable protocols, RFC 5246 TCP, transmission control protocol. Keeping a connection alive without permanent traffic is not foreseen in this. And we don't want a lot of permanent traffic in this between the connections because it uses performance, bandwidth, and so on. And we don't have this foreseen in the RFC. This is one reason why we have this heartbeat extension. The second one is datagram transport layer security. This is designed to secure traffic running on top of unreliable transport protocols. What is an unreliable transport protocol? UDP, exactly. So mostly what we're talking about here is UDP. This is TCP, this is UDP. And in UDP we have another two problems, according to this, whether the connection is alive or not. We have, of course, this one, the same problem with the whether it's a partner alive, but we also have something called path MTNU discovery. What is MTNU? MTU? maximum transfer unit, exactly. So this means the maximum transfer unit, when we fragment our packets, we need to know which way is possible to send our packets. Because if we send a packet fragment which is too big for the for a dedicated link, the router before this link will drop the packet. And so UDP has no connection. We don't get any information whether the packets get lost or not. Then we have a problem. So the UDP needs information about the MTU size of the path to the partner. And to get this information, Heartbeat extension will help us. And the third thing we have is network address translation. So if we have an interconnection with a NAT device, NAT gateway, it is important to have the information. Is the NAT gateway still available so that the NAT device does not borrow the blocked addresses for our connection to another connection so that we get our parameters here. So if we have a regular exchange of messages between NAT devices, we keep our parameters actual. Now, when you read the RFC, we have a lot of definitions in this, not so many, but some. And the first is the Heartbeat protocol. And the Heartbeat protocol is defined in the form that we have a Heartbeat request message and we had a Heartbeat response message. We have two message types, Heartbeat request, Heartbeat response. And a Heartbeat request can arrive almost at any time during the life of any connection. That's the definition. So you can send a Heartbeat request all the time if you want, so long the connection interconnection is established. And the second thing is, a Heartbeat request should be answered with a corresponding Heartbeat response. Therefore, you see here the word should in capital letters. Each RC has a clear definition of what is necessary when you write must, should, or can. So should means it should answer, but it's not not possible or necessary in every case. So what we see here is we send a request and we expect a response, and mostly the response should be come. Now let's talk about the structure of the Heartbeat message. Well, we have a Heartbeat message type, request and respond. It was what we have here. We have unit payload length. This is what you remember from the comic. We say, please answer with the word hat, the length 500 letters. we have an undefined payload, which is hopefully depending on the payload length. You see here in the RFC, it is defined in the right way. We see later on that the Heartbleed flaw was a misconfiguration of this definition. And we have a padding field so that we can pad the request message. This is so to find out whether the MTU size is possible to transfer to the sender. We can add padding bits in this. And this is a Heartbeat message. The RFC as well says that if the payload length of a received Heartbeat message is too large, the received Heartbeat message must be discarded silently. Must. So what we saw in the comic should not appear when the developer of this Heartbeat extension would read the RFC in the right way. Okay? Now some words about software security and problems with memory administration or control or allocation. A typical problem in memory allocation is in the field of buffer overflow. It's an old flaw. It's in the beginning of the 90s, appears the first time, and programmers are not able to fix this problem since today. So buffer overflow appears always because of bad quality in software development. How does it work? Yes, this is the simple way. We have a memory. This is a simple board. This is an important message which contains new instructions of the research department and confidential information about the access to the research repository of the RD department, username, password. So if we do not take care that our memory is in the size that we can put all over our information in, we overwrite the memory, and here could be anything. Another point of memory, or the message could be disappeared, but if it is another part of memory, it could be read by another unauthorized person or whatnot. This is a typical buffer overflow. And we have this problem because of a typical memory structure I will show here on the x86 CPU. We have a normal memory, and the memory is has different parts. We have normally, this is a rough model, we have the text area, which is normally, here we place the code, which is read-only. We have some data area, which is for static memory. We have this heap area, which is the dynamic memory, and this is the dangerous one, or the complex one we are talking about. Here we have memory allocation, calloc, realloc, free possibilities, using the language C to administer our memory by ourselves. And so here we can write, override memories, here we can access memories where we don't have access, and so on. And here we have the stack, where we have return addresses, local variables, and so on. So if we, for example, this is a buffer overflow function, implement any jump or return address to the stack, we are able to jump to a stack address, and then any function or whatever on this address is stored will be performed. So this is the typical way, and take care that we have this kind of heap in this way. In the buffer overflow, we try to get information from this heap, or to write information in this heap, to start programs, to start a shell, to get access to any other variables. And the way we are talking about hard bleed is the way we want to read as much as possible from this heap, hoping to get information about passwords, certificates, or whatever. This was a short detour to memory allocation so that we understand what's going on in the hard bleed floor. So the hard bleed floor is implemented in the OpenSSL library. OpenSSL is an open source project that provides a robust, commercial grade, and full feature toolkit for the transport layer security and secure circuit layer protocols. It is also a general purpose cryptographic library. It is used very often. It is an open source project, and many, many web servers, Apache, for example, use OpenSSL to set up secure transport layer security sessions. So it is used very often, but it is an open source project. And here is one of the problems we see, and this is also a reason why this hard bleed appears. OpenSSL project consists of 11 members. Sometimes more, sometimes less, but around this. And only 10 of these are volunteers, and only one is full-time employee. The reason for this is the budget is $1 million per year, relies on parts of donation. So they don't have so much money. And what we see here is that a huge community is relying on a project which is not very well supported by money and people. And this is one of the biggest problems, and this is also the reason why we think that hard bleed will be appeared. Okay, heartbeat implementation. Heartbeat was, of course, implemented after the RFC was published. And by the way, the developer of this heartbeat implementation, OpenSSL, were also the authors of this RFC. I don't show you the name, but I show you where they come from. The security bug in the OpenSSL cryptography library was implemented. It was first published. The software with the flaw was first published in March 2012. Developed was this by a student at the Fachhochschule Münster and University of Duisburg Essen in Germany, and they are also the authors of this RFC. So they developed during PhD work this code, published it, and then it was after some time implemented by this full-time employee of the OpenSSL project. So this was the time where the Germans were not able to program very good software. But we are very happy that Volkswagen was developing very successful software now, and then show the world that the Germans are able to make good quality software. But in this case, it was not. Okay, no efficient quality control in software development was the reason for this, said the community, said the Open SSL project, because of less resources. So they said by themselves, we don't have the resources to make a clear, good software development quality assessment. And this is a little bit crazy, not very well, because we are relying on a software for secure access to web servers, mail servers, whatever, which are based on a project where the developers itself say, we don't have the resources for very good software quality management. Okay, the flaw was discovered on the 4th of April in 2014. Here we see it was more than 2 years later. So the flaw was running on web servers, Apache and others, for more than 2 years. It was detected more or less simultaneously by Codenomicon, a guy in Finland. This is the company where he worked, and someone from Google. And at this time, 70% of all web servers worldwide were affected by this hard bleed flaw. And when we talk about 17%, we talk about 500,000 web servers in 2014. It was fixed on the 7th of April, so when it was published, relatively fast, a fix was available in the version 1.0.0g. But in the end of June 2014, so 3 months later, there were still more than 309,000 web servers running, remaining with this vulnerability. So what you see here is, it takes time that the web servers will fix this kind of SSL, open SSL version. And I'm sure, I don't know no numbers, but I'm sure that there are still some servers running with this kind of flaw. Now, some words before we finish. I have three slides more. How does Heartbleed work in technical? Well, the attacker sends a heartbeat payload of 1 byte and argued that payload length is 16 kilobytes. Then the victim allocates memory, 16 kilobytes, plus some admin info, because the payload length is 16 kilobytes. It defines a buffer, OpenSSL malloc, which is an OpenSSL memory allocation function, not the memory allocation function of C, and was allocating this kind of memory, and was assigning this buffer to the variable BP. And then it starts memory copy of the pointer BP with the payload and according to the payload length. And the payload length is 16 kilobytes. And the payload is 1 byte. So we copy from the recording pointer in the memory the payload, but with a length which is much more than the 1 byte of the real payload. This means that if we look to this picture, we have the pointer here to our payload, 1 byte, but we copy all these 16 kilobytes to the client. And we can read out, in this case, something which is written in the heap, memory heap of our system. And the problem is, it's a little bit random. What is written in this heap? Could be nothing, could be very interesting data. What we of course can do, we can repeat all these this request as often as possible, and then we get hopefully other information. But the OpenSSL community, the programmers, were much more hacker friendly. What they did is something like open SSL malloc. This memory allocation function is implemented by them, and it's an old memory allocation function. And this gives us the opportunity to find more interesting material in this memory allocation function is much more higher. So here you find special data in the context of open SSL, and exactly this is what we want if we are the hackers. We want passwords, decrypted data, because they are here decrypted in the memory, and secret keys and certificates of the server. And this is what happened. So you send this request, and with a higher number of memory, and you get a lot of information. You do it twice, three, four, five, 20 times. And hopefully after some times you have certificates, you have keys, you have master keys, you have decrypted data, you have passwords, whatever. And the interesting thing in this is, if this bug is not fixed, you can use this also 2 weeks later or 1 month later, as often as you are in this connection. When you have a man in the middle, the connection, you can use this kind of information for a long time. It was possible to read out until 64 kilobyte blocks, which was not part of the RFC. There we have 16 kilobytes as maximum. But the implementation gave us the possibility to read out until 64 kilobyte blocks. So the possibility to read out a lot of useful information was very huge. And the bad thing from the view of the defender of Heartbleed was it does not override any memory on the targeted systems. So we have no traces afterwards. If somebody has read out the information, certificates, whatever, there is no trace because they never write down in the memory, hey, I have read this wonderful certificate, something like this. So no system crash occur because the memory will not be affected. An attack will not be detected because there is no trace. And the disclosed certificates and keys can be used also in later cases. So this Heartbleed is a very, very serious and dangerous flaw. And Bruce Snyder said something similar to, if we have a scale of the danger of flaws between 1 and 10, Heartbleed is number 11. So at this time, it was very, very strong. And in the beginning of 2014, you could not be sure that any of your TLS connection would be safe or not. Okay, that was the short detour to Heartbleed. Are there any questions? Now you should use the microphone. Okay, I repeat the question. No. I only mentioned buffer overflow because I want to show how the memory of computers is organized. It is the opposite way. The buffer overflow tries to write something in the area of the memory where the Heartbleed tries to read information. And because of the implementation of this memory allocation function from OpenSSL, the probability to get interesting information is better. But you only read, no writing. Buffer overflow writes normally. Of what?
Will that be a mean to help to prevent those kind of things?
I have no idea.
Because that's actually, you are randomizing the address space, so the heap.
Yeah. Well, this problem is fixed in the way that that the server is checking the payload length value. So then,
because I looked it up and I see that most operating system from like 2003 implementing ASLR in the OSS. But what I also noticed is that March in 2014, it was a safer and better implementation on Linux.
Okay.
So that could be maybe a result that I actually are looking over.
Could
there.
Be, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, to comment on that, ACLR actually won't be protecting you, because what you're doing here is you get some random space in memory and you try to read another random space. ACLR is to attempt to stop you to predict memory addresses, but you don't even deal with addresses. You just look someplace in memory and hope that you get what you want. You don't even know where, so... It does spread where you're positioned, but essentially this uses its own memory allocation function, so which could limit effectiveness of ASLR, essentially.
Any other questions?
I have a question. But you said that maybe not all servers are secure now. Maybe not all have patched the bug. How can I be sure when I use a server? How can I test it? Except maybe attack them.
Yes. I have no idea. I misread it. Sorry. You have a question?
No more questions. Then thanks, Thomas, for a very good presentation. Go ahead. I mean, we can thank the speaker. The assignment you have is on Heartbleed, so you got some more information here. I will make the slides available also. If you looked closely, then you saw that there were some links in there that you could find some more information also. At least there was a German link. I'm not... if you speak German or if you use Google Translate, you can find some more. Yeah. But they can find information there. Okay, good. I guess if they have questions afterwards, you will be willing to answer them over email or whatever. Yeah. Okay, thanks again, Thomas. Is it? Yeah. That concludes the presentations for today. Next week we'll go over to system security and no longer network security. That's it for today. Thanks.